Good morning, Your Honors. Christine Grieve for the, on behalf of respondents. May it please the court, I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Sure. Watch your time.
Thank you. Your Honors, we are asking this court to reverse the lower court's decision and deny habeas relief. Scannador made a voluntary and intelligent choice as to the best course of action in his best interest, and he faced near certain conviction on first-degree felony murder with robbery, with the use of a deadly weapon, robbery, and other charges. And instead, he pled to second-degree murder and secured a term of 10 to 15 years without the deadly weapon enhancement. And that is the very sort of it, voluntary and intelligent choice that satisfies due process for the entry of a plea. The lower court decided there was a factual flaw in the state court's decision because it did not explicitly discuss the state law requirements for implied malice. But by focusing on that small piece of the puzzle, the lower court erred by setting aside the state court's reasonable factual determinations in favor of its own debatable interpretation of the record. Importantly, the state court's not required to address all of the evidence before it. The state court was aware of Scannador's argument that he did not understand the implied malice element and simply did not agree.
Counsel, so I had a couple questions for you concerning first the plea agreement in this case. In my experience with plea agreements, now I was a federal guy, not a state court guy, mm-hmm. but as a federal guy, the elements of the offense were always in the plea agreement that the defendant signed, and therefore there would be no dispute over what exactly the guy pled guilty to. Did he understand? Did he not? My understanding is the plea agreement in this case, at least at the time back then, does not have the elements of the offense spelled out. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So what we have in terms of proof that he knew what the elements were, we have the fact that during the plea colloquy, he said he understood the elements, correct?
Yes.
And then we have the representations of counsel that he explained the elements of the offense to Mr. Scannador. Is that correct?
Yes, we do.
Is there anything else other than those two? Because I want to make sure I understand what is the basis for us to be comfortable under AEDPA that he understood the elements. We have the representation in the plea agreement and then in the change of plea hearing. And then we have the lawyer's statements in the, what he signed saying, I explained the elements of the offense, or I explained the nature of the offense, I think is what he says. Is that correct?
Yes, we have the guilty plea agreement and the plea colloquy. In our opinion, the statements made by counsel are sufficient under the Bradshaw presumption to show that he understood the elements of the offense.
And no, I appreciate the argument there. Is there anything else in the galaxy of things we can look to?
There's also the evidentiary hearing transcript where counsel also, again, stated that he had explained the elements of the offense. I do not believe...
But at the time of the plea, which is... At the time of the plea, which is the main focus, what we look at, it would be the statements made by counsel that he that he explained the nature of the offense, and then the Mr. Scannador saying he understood what the nature of the offense during the hearing, correct?
Correct.
Okay.
In making its decision, the lower court made two debatable inferences, and the first one we just discussed, that counsel explained the elements of the offense, and that's sufficient under the Bradshaw presumption. The second inference that the court made was that the state court erroneously substituted the first degree elements for second degree elements of for implied malice in its analysis. But in the context of the whole record, the state court discussed the first degree murder charge as part of the background of Scannador's decision to enter his plea. And ultimately, this case followed the regular plea bargaining process. Under the totality of the circumstances, it was not an unreasonable factual determination that Scannador understood the requisite implied malice element.
And then I also had a question for you about...
Sure.
Because there were two charges he pled guilty to, correct?
Yes.
There was second-degree murder, and then there was also the conspiracy to commit robbery.
Correct.
Now, am I right that on the conspiracy to commit robbery, he has served his term on that sentence?
Yes.
How much time, do you happen to know how much time is left on his second-degree murder charge?
Um,
Maybe I'll ask opposing counsel if you don't know. It's got to be close to being done.
It does have to be. Well, it's going to be close to the eligibility for parole date. He was sentenced in 2017, and it was a minimum of 10 years. So, yeah, he's coming up on his parole eligibility date.
Okay. And under Nevada law, is there any good credit time?
There is, yes.
So conceivably?
Conceivably, yes. He could be eligible.
Okay.
And finally, we would ask that even if this court affirms the grant of the writ, the original charges from the first amended information must be reinstated. And that would return both parties to their status from before the plea bargain.
So he'd be facing a first-degree murder charge?
Correct. And if there are no more questions, I will reserve the remainder of my time.
All right, thank you. You got 9 minutes.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Shelley Richter, and I represent appellee Jonathan Skenendorp. When it came time for Jonathan to enter his guilty plea, this was not a first-degree felony murder case anymore, but everyone in the courtroom still treated it that way. And this was a problem because Jonathan needed to understand what he was pleading guilty to, and that wasn't felony murder. He was pleading guilty to killing with a depraved heart, to subjectively knowing that what he was doing had a high likelihood of causing death and just not caring. The district court...
this is a fictitious plea. Do you guys think it was a fictitious plea or not?
I'm not sure if I would characterize it as a fictitious plea, but regardless, even if it is, Jonathan needed to understand the elements of the crime he was pleading guilty to.
I think you're right about that. Let's back up, though. Is there a federal constitutional problem, or at least one recognized under EPA for fictitious pleas? If it was a fictitious plea, is that itself a problem, or is that okay?
That's not the error we're raising. The error we're raising is him not understanding the elements of the crime he's pleading guilty to.
That's really important, actually, because the district court judge here, as I recall, relied on the fact that during his testimony or his plea allocution, or however you say that he talked about doing things that did not match up to the elements of what he pled to. Do you recall that from the district court?
Right. He said that.
So if that's the case, and district court seemed to rely pretty heavily on that, but the problem is if you have a fictitious plea and you have a person pleading that's being asked what they did, or, you know, at least they're talking about what they did, they're never going to match up, right? Because, I mean, to use an extreme example, if you committed murder, it had no robbery involved, but you pled to robbery. I don't think they probably ever do fictitious pleas that are that far afield. But if the person's talking about what they did, it's never going to match up to robbery, what they're pleading to. Maybe if you went through like they do in federal court and you said, what are the elements of what you're pleading to? But do you agree that, and if you don't agree, I'm curious as to why I would be wrong about it, that what he said in court is just irrelevant to whether he understood, because he was asked about what he did, and what he did wouldn't match up to a fictitious plea. It never would.
If that was the only indication that he didn't understand the elements, I might be more inclined to agree with Your Honor's concern.
Let me pin you down a little bit on that. So you're going to say there's other stuff, but that itself is completely irrelevant, isn't it?
No, it's not completely irrelevant.
So why is it not irrelevant?
Because he's asked in the context of the charging document and the court explaining the charge, do you understand what you did? Yes, and then he explains what he did in the context of the charge. And what he explained was, oh, I was involved with some guys, they went to rob someone and someone died.
Yeah, but so he explained what he did, and what he did is never going to match up to the elements of the plea if the plea is a fictitious, if he's pleading to a fictitious crime.
But the parties could have made that clear, the court or the prosecutor, even the defense attorney.
So is that more your argument, that it wasn't clear enough? Not so much that it's wrong that they didn't match up, but that it just wasn't clear enough so are you arguing that he should have said that the state court was required to go through the elements?
That's one way it could have been done. An easy way this could have happened was the second amended information could have said he killed with malice, expressed or implied, and then when the court would have read that as a statement of the elements, the court would have again said, you're charged with killing with malice, expressed or implied. Do you agree you did that? Yes. And so that would provide more of a basis for him understanding that malice element, which he didn't understand. And so because we don't have that, right, because...
And his evidence that he didn't understand that is... And again, the district court, I think, relied on the fact that what he said he did didn't match up. But I don't think that's evidence. The other evidence is his statements later. What other evidence is there other than his statements later when he said, I didn't understand back then?
One important one was at sentencing, trial counsel said that he had explained felony murder to Jonathan. And the whole context of this case was a felony murder case. The preliminary hearing was all about felony murder. The charging documents were all about felony murder. The second amendment information said he'd killed in the perpetration of a robbery or an attempted perpetration. And so that's really how he's understanding this case is as felony murder. And because the second amendment information was deficient in not charging the elements, and then the court then read that those elements again, and those were deficient because they're the felony murder elements, and no one is stepping in, and no one is saying, actually, malice is an element here, then that all suggests he doesn't understand it, because how would he? He's 19 years old. How would he just on his own know that depraved heart is an element of what he's pleading guilty to?
Well, he did say that he was, I mean, there are the statements that are in the record that he said that his lawyer had told him what he was pleading to and all that. And so we should just assume that, I guess, because it seems like the rule you're asking for is notwithstanding that he said that he understood, had been told the elements, and usually there's a presumption that when somebody says their lawyer says that we believe them. But in this case, because of his age, is that what's on the other, his age or?
One of the biggest factors is the language of the second amended information that he pleaded guilty to, because it pleads that Grant died in the course of a robbery.
But if we were to agree with you on that, on the language that it's not in the language of Second Amendment complaint, and you seem to be relying heavily on, and or the fact that the elements weren't said by the judge at the hearing, wouldn't we, especially taken in contrast to the fact that he did say that he was told the elements, his lawyer did say crime that he pled to, he had been explained to him. Wouldn't we be creating sort of a bright line rule that the Second Amendment complaint has to have those elements in it? Is that what you're asking for? Is for us to create that bright line rule?
No. We're just asking for an application of Henderson versus Morgan and other Supreme Court law about pleas, which require.
But in Henderson, the facts are different. If I recall that Didn't the trial court find as a fact that he had not had the elements explained to him, Henderson?
I believe so. But the main similarity between here and Henderson was he was very clearly guilty of first-degree murder. He'd went into a woman's home, stabbed her 45 times, and was charged with first-degree murder. And he pleaded, and there was an information charging first-degree murder. And then he pleaded guilty to second-degree murder without having the elements of that charge pleaded. And so he was also 19 years old when he went to plead. They weren't spoken out loud. And then he alleged in habeas that his plea wasn't knowing and intelligent, and the Supreme Court agreed. And so there really are a lot of similarities between here and Henderson versus Morgan in that, again, maybe he's understanding felony murder, but felony murder isn't what he's pleading guilty to.
So, counsel, I mean, I want to jump in there on that point. I mean, do you dispute that this record makes it very clear everyone understood that he had been charged with a bigger offense, with a bigger possible punishment, and the parties agreed to come up with a way for him to plead where he would have a lesser exposure to punishment? Is there any doubt that everybody understood that's what was going on here?
I agree with that. It was a plea deal to take the first-degree felony murder off the table. But even in the context of a plea deal, the defendant still needs to understand the elements that he's pleading guilty to. And normally that just isn't a problem because there'll be a correct amended information
filed. Well, this comes back to the fictional plea idea that Judge Van Dyke was asking about of, I mean, we have a record where he says at his hearing, everything was explained to me. I went over this with my lawyer. I read the agreement. I understand it. This is what I want to do. The lawyer confirms all of those things when he's asked to testify about these things in habeas proceedings. Again, says, I spoke with my client. We had enough time. He said he understood. And so with that record and with the sort of larger context of what everybody understood was happening here, it's a difficult lift, it seems, even under Henderson and the other cases that you've cited in your briefs, to say that we don't have a record of voluntariness and knowing here.
We don't have a record because this is really just this unique and rare and frankly strange situation where when the case switched to the plea, the parties didn't really recognize that the elements changed. So we still have defense counsel at sentencing saying he explained felony murder. We still have the judge during the plea saying the elements of felony murder. And so, yes, Jonathan is saying he was explained the elements and he understands, but what he understands is felony murder and it's not correct. And so that's what brings us into the ambit of Henderson versus Morgan and Hicks, that 10th Circuit case from 2008, which is really on point. It's when that switch happens, the parties need to understand that the elements might change and act accordingly. And that unfortunately just didn't happen here. I also wanted to address Judge Owens, your question about his sentence structure. He was already eligible for parole last year. Parole was denied. He'll have another parole hearing in a few months. So he's parole eligible again in January, and he will expire his sentence in November of 2029. So there is substantial time left on that second degree murder sentence. Let's see. It sounds like the court is in agreement that him knowing the elements of felony murder doesn't mean that he knows the elements of depraved heart. But that really is the sort of crux of our argument, is just because he knows.
I think that's true as a matter of logic, right? But it almost feels like you're asking us to accept a different logical error, the either or fallacy, which is you've really impressed on the fact that he apparently knew the elements of felony murder. He knew that he'd committed felony murder, all this stuff. And it feels a little bit like you're trying to get us to take that as evidence that he didn't understand the elements of what he pled to. Moreover, notwithstanding the fact that he did say he did, and his lawyer did say that he did. But the fact that you know all the elements of this other thing doesn't mean you don't know the elements of this one. You have to show that he didn't know the elements of this other one. And your evidence, and the district court's evidence for that, was that when he talked about what he did, it didn't match up to this other one. But as I already said, that doesn't tell us anything. It's not relevant. The other evidence of that, I guess, is that later on he said that he didn't know that. And I guess you're relying on, there's also a lot of evidence that he understood that he committed felony murder. But none of that necessarily demonstrates that he didn't know the elements of what he pled to. And he did say he did. So I'm trying to figure out what evidence you've got that actually is, we can put on the scales to weigh against that he said that he did and that his lawyer said that he did.
Right. I mean, it is a totality of circumstances argument that we're making. I mean, first is the fact that at post-conviction evidentiary hearing, he said he did not understand implied malice. So there's that. And
how much should we weigh that? I mean, those kind of states, it's a little bit self-serving, right?
Understandable. But here the context really supports that, because the context is this is a felony murder case. The charging document isn't ever corrected. The judge reads felony murder elements. Defense counsel says at sentencing, I explained felony murder. And so the overall context really supports what he's saying, which is he didn't understand.
Another way to put that is that what we have supporting that he understood the elements of what he actually pled to are his statement that he did, his generalized statement. He didn't like go through the elements, understandable, and his lawyer's statement. But the other stuff you're mentioning is not really evidence that he didn't understand those things. The other stuff is just evidence that he also understood what he had actually done, which seems kind of important too, I suppose, you know, just as a practical matter. If you're going to do a fictitious plea, you hope they did something. So I'm still struggling to see what actually weighs against the evidence we do have that he understood it, which is admittedly just his statement and his lawyer's statement in general terms?
The evidence that shows that he did not understand, it's just the context of what would have been explained to him. The lawyer wouldn't explain to him elements that he's not charged with, right? The second amended information is pleading death in the course of a robbery. So, of course, his attorney would explain to him what death in the course.
I think his lawyer did say that he did explain to him the elements of what he pled to.
But what he pled to, as alleged by the district attorney, was death in the course of a robbery. So there's no reason to think his attorney would have gone out of his way and explained the elements of depraved heart when that's not charged by the district attorney. So what the district attorney is saying, even in the context of the plea, is this was felony murder. So, of course, his attorney is explaining this is what felony murder means. There was just this, I think, lack of understanding that second-degree murder in Nevada couldn't take robbery as a predicate. And that's something that was developed later. And because the parties didn't understand that, they were under this misimpression that felony murder could still support that second-degree murder plea when it couldn't. So if the court has no further questions, I see I'm coming on my time, and I would ask the court to affirm. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
I think that the court has come to, or has stated that it kind of knows what's going on here, that everyone in the lower court knew what was going on here. And again, we do have the guilty plea agreement where counsel explicitly certified that he explained the charges that he had pled to. While my friend on the other side says that there's no reason for counsel to explain those different parts of second-degree murder, that's not the rule here. The rule is that we assume that counsel did explain unless there's something to overcome that presumption. And here there is not. It doesn't matter whether under what theory the second-degree murder is, as long as he explained that it could be under this theory, it could be under this theory, you've met the implied malice element because of these circumstances. And here we don't have anything showing that counsel did not explain that. Importantly, Skenador did not raise any questions or concerns at his canvas. And I believe in Hicks, that was part of why the court said that this was, again, a very unique circumstance, that he did raise those questions and concerns at his plea canvas. And admittedly, the record here does not follow the best practices, but there's no constitutional requirement for plea mechanics, specific plea mechanics. And if there are no other questions, we ask this court to reverse.
All right, thank you very much, counsel. I want to thank both of you for your briefing and your argument in this case. I especially want to thank Ms. Richter and her office for stepping up to take these cases. A lot of federal defenders' offices do not take state habeas cases. Your office does, and I appreciate that you do. On top of everything else that your office does, you step up and take on these cases, which are challenging. You've done a great job. But thank you very much, counsel.